Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. We come to you 7 days a week from the Voice of America in Washington. If English is not your first language, we make it easier to understand our stories by speaking a little more slowly than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Today we have two stories for you. We will look back 50 years to an important event in American musical history. It was a time, some people say, that changed American music forever. Then we are off to Myanmar to hear about farmers who are switching from growing poppies and planting coffee instead. So if you're ready, let's get started with part one. Katie Weaver is here to talk about American music history.
50 years ago, the well-loved musician Bob Dylan played at the Newport Folk Festival and was widely booed. The audience may have been unhappy, but Dylan's performance helped change the direction of music and culture in the United States.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing.
The mid-1960s were a time of great change. One such place of change was the world of folk music. Music legend Bob Dylan became a symbol of change when he moved from acoustic to electric guitar. Rock music historian Elijah Wald has written a new book about the change. It is called Dylan Goes Electric.
There was a moment in the early 60s where you could look at the Billboard charts and 7 of the top 10 albums were folk records. And, you know, Joan Baez, Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, all had huge, huge, huge number one records.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd a hammer out danger, I'd a hammer out a warning, I'd a hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters.
And then this happened.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand.
The British invasion introduced the world to the Beatles and grew a huge fan base for rock music. That worried many folk musicians, says Elijah Wald.
In 1964, the Beatles had hit. By 1965, by the summer of 1965, a lot of people in the folk scene were sort of feeling like their world was threatened.
They hoped that Bob Dylan would come to the rescue. Dylan was a major artist in folk music, a powerful songwriter and unusual singer. In 1965, Dylan was booked to perform at the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. He had performed at the festival in 1963 and 1964 with folk singer Joan Baez. The crowd was expecting to see a similar show with a traditional sound like this.
Many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man.
Instead, a new Dylan sound came from the stage.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Bob Dylan had gone electric, and the followers of folk music were not pleased.
When Dylan went electric, I think one of the issues was the feeling that, wait a minute, he's gone over to the enemy.
At first, the Newport audience was quiet, seemingly in shock. Then, the crowd began to boo. Folk lovers had looked to Bob Dylan to save their movement from rock and roll. But author Wald says Dylan felt differently about the music genre.
Dylan had always liked rock and roll, and Dylan didn't think of rock and roll as stupid music.
In fact, Dylan was a Beatles fan. He later said that from the first time he heard the Beatles, he knew, quote, they were pointing to the direction where music had to go.
Honestly, once the Beatles hit, I think that the writing was on the wall. But when Dylan went with the Beatles on that one, that was that. That was essentially the end of the folk scene as a huge mainstream pop trend.
Beyond the music, Dylan's performance that night also marked a turn in American culture.
Before 1965 was really a different world, and it's the 60s of the civil rights movement and of folk music and of joining arms across the generations and across the races. And after 1965, it's the world of rock. I'm not saying Dylan created that change, but I do think that the confrontation at Newport happened because it was symbolic of that much larger confrontation and has been remembered because it really is sort of the moment of rupture where the new 60s emerged.
I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Large numbers of opium poppy plants grow in the mountains of Myanmar's Shan State. In fact, Shan State is the second largest opium-producing area in the world. After a drop in production during the 2000s, the number of poppies has risen in the past 8 years. Some experts have linked the increased production to a growing demand for the drug heroin in China. But Myanmar's poppy farmers are now earning less on their crops. Now the United Nations is hoping many will decide to grow coffee instead. Bob Doty tells us more.
For years, thousands of Shan State farmers have earned more profit from sales of opium poppy than from other crops. But poppy prices fluctuate. They may rise one month, but fall the next. 54-year-old Long San is a poppy farmer. He was one of 400 growers who last year joined a UN-supported crop replacement program. Long San is now growing coffee. So far, Myanmar's efforts to cut down on poppy growing have done little to stop the farmers. A UN study found that more than 57,000 hectares of poppy were grown in Shan State last year. That is almost three times the area farmed in 2006. That has made Myanmar second, only to Afghanistan, in production. But drug traffickers can be bad business partners. The UN's Yokan Wees says farmers have a better choice.
You have to find something which is economically competitive and also sustainable. And we having here is the altitudes in between 1,000 and 1,700 meters, where the main poppy production takes place. And this is just the precise area where you can grow high-quality coffee.
It will still be a few years before the coffee plants are ready to harvest. But until then, growers continue to receive seeds, tools, and training. There are currently 200 hectares of coffee being grown. UN officials hope the area could expand to 600 hectares by the end of the year. A major concern, however, is the struggle for territory between ethnic armed groups and the government. For now, the young coffee plants occupy just a small part of Shan State's poppy fields. But they represent hope that this area will one day be known for its coffee, not its opium. I'm Bob Doty.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. This is part one of a two-part series, Comparing English Language Proficiency Tests. International students and workers must take a standardized test of English to move into higher levels of education and employment. There are three popular tests that universities or employers can use. They are the Test of English as a Foreign Language, TOEFL, the Test of English for International Communication, TOEIC, and the International English Language Testing System, IELTS. In most cases, the choice is clear. A student applying to a school learns which test the program requires. However, some programs or universities will accept scores from any of the international tests of English. Then, a student may choose which test to take. The Educational Testing Service, ETS, in Princeton, New Jersey, develops and administers both the TOEFL and the TOEIC. It says the TOEIC measures the everyday English skills of people working in an international environment. The TOEIC is based on English used in the workplace. The questions come from real situations, like attending a company meeting. Organizations sometimes use the TOEIC to measure progress in English training programs. There are several versions of the TOEFL. Students take the internet-based TOEFL, or TOEFL IBT, on a computer. Many U.S. universities require the TOEFL IBT for international student admissions. Another TOEFL is the paper-based TOEFL, or TOEFL ITP. It is part of ETS's institutional testing program. TOEFL ITP is used within institutions for the purpose of placement or to evaluate progress of students. The IELTS has two forms. The listening and speaking sections are the same for both forms. In the reading and writing sections, however, there are two different tests. The academic IELTS uses topics and materials covered in undergraduate, graduate, or professional programs. The general IELTS uses topics and material from everyday books, newspapers, and magazines. Triwik Kurniasari is a graduate student at an American university. She has taken both the IBT and ITP forms of the TOEFL and the IELTS. She says the paper-based or institutional test, the TOEFL ITP, is easier. The ITP is similar to the multiple-choice tests students usually take. A major difference between the TOEFL IBT and the IELTS is in the speaking section. On the IELTS, you have a face-to-face interview with a certified examiner. On the TOEFL IBT, you listen to a situation and record your response using a computer. Next week, Triwik Kurniasari continues to compare the test and gives her advice to students on how to prepare. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we look at the history of early American Indians. The native peoples of North and South America came from Siberia thousands of years ago. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska before the end of the last ice age. As the groups settled different parts of the land, they developed their own cultures and religions. Each group's story is important in the history of the Americas. But our story today will focus on the tribes in what became the central part of the United States. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led a group of explorers to the Pacific Ocean. They met the tribes of the Great Plains. The explorers were perhaps the first white people these Native Americans had ever seen. When the group of explorers neared the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, they encountered the Shoshone tribe. Meriwether Lewis was the first to see them. Imagine for a moment that we are with Meriwether Lewis near the Rocky Mountains. Across a small hill, a group of 60 Shoshone men are riding toward us. The first thing we see is that these men are ready for war. Each is armed with a bow and arrow. Some carry long poles with a sharp knife at the end. They are riding very fast. Some of the horses look like they do not have riders. But as they get closer, we see that the riders are hanging off the sides of the horses or under the neck. They are using the horses' bodies for protection. The horses are painted with many different designs in blue, black, red, and other colors. Later, we learn that each design has a special meaning for the man who owns the horse. Each one tells a story. For example, the rider of one of the horses is a leader in battle. Another has killed an enemy. As they come nearer, the Shoshone group sees that we are not ready for war. They slow their horses, but are still very careful. Meriwether Lewis holds up an open hand as a sign of peace. The leader of the Shoshone does the same. They come closer. The Shoshone are dressed in clothes made from animal skins. Most of these skins are from deer or buffalo. The skins also have designs and tell stories like the designs on the horses. One design shows that someone has fought in a battle. Another shows that the person has been in many raids to capture horses. Still another shows that someone saved the life of a friend. Meriwether Lewis smiles at these men. He and the Shoshone chief cannot speak each other's language. The explorer again makes a sign of peace, and the sign is again returned. One young Shoshone comes near. He gets off his horse. He is tall and looks strong. His hair is long and black. He wears one long bird feather in the back of his hair. His arms have been painted with long lines. We learn that each line represents a battle. There are many lines on his arms. Fortunately, we are able to continue our travels without a need for him to add another line. Many tribes, including the Shoshone, populated the area known as the Great Plains. The land they lived on influenced the lives and cultures of these Indian nations. The plains stretch across the central part of the country and north into Canada and south to Mexico. Even in a car traveling at 100 kilometers an hour, it can take 2 long days of driving to cross the Great Plains. In the east, the plains begin near the Mississippi River and go west to the huge Rocky Mountains. There are big rivers here and deserts. Some areas are so flat that a person can see for hundreds of kilometers. Huge areas of this land were once covered by thick grasses. Those grasses provided food for an animal that made possible the culture of the Indians of the Great Plains. The grass fed the buffalo or bison that were the center of native culture in the Great Plains. The huge animals provided meat for the Indians and much more. They were an important part of the religion of most of the native people of the Great Plains. The Lakota tribe, sometimes called the Sioux, believed that everything necessary for life could be found in the buffalo. The back of the animal provided the thick skins that the Plains Indians used to make their homes. Other parts of the buffalo hide were made into clothing and warm blankets. The bones were made into tools. No part of the animal was wasted. No one knows how many buffalo were in North America when Meriwether Lewis first met the Shoshone. But experts believe there were probably between 60 million and 75 million. Another animal also played an important part in the Indian cultures of the Great Plains. When Native Americans first saw these animals, they called them big dogs or mystery dogs. They had no word for this kind of animal in their languages. We know it as the horse. The horse had long been extinct in North America.
You have to understand that there were horse species here, you know, millions of years ago, but they died out 10,000 years ago, and so no one had seen a horse.
Until the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Spanish explorers. Emil Hermeni Horses, curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, describes the, at first, frightening sight to the Native Americans.
So what comes back with the Spaniards, with Christopher Columbus on his second voyage, are horses as we know them today, the large animals. And so you can understand that people who had never seen these before, then to see a rider on top of it, dressed in armor, it must have looked like this tank coming at you that you did not know what it was. So of course it struck fear. The Spaniards, the conquistadors capitalized on that, realizing that it was causing fear and confusion, that they actually put bells on here. So even adding that extra level of noise to frighten the natives who never encountered the horse.
Before the introduction of horses to North America, Indians mostly traveled by foot. Traveling long distances was difficult. So was hunting buffalo. The horse greatly changed life for the tribes of the Great Plains. It gave them a new way to travel and to carry food and equipment. It made it easier and safer for them to follow and hunt the buffalo.
Originally, you may have killed one or two buffalo, where if you're on horseback, you'd be able to kill more buffalo.
The Smithsonian's Emil Hermeni Horses, who is a member of the Oglala Lakota.
And with killing more buffalo, you had more meat, you had more resources to make clothing from the hides, and also to make teepees. So things became more and bigger. So you might see a bigger teepee because you had more hides, you were able to kill more buffalo and process it, and so more abundance.
The horse made it possible to attack an enemy far away and return safely. The measure of a tribe's wealth became the number of horses it owned. Spanish settlers rode horses to the small town of Santa Fe in what is now the southwestern state of New Mexico. They arrived there in about 1609. How Native Americans got their first horses is not known. Perhaps they traded for them, perhaps they captured them. Soon, many tribes were doing both. By the 1750s, all the tribes of the Great Plains had horses. They had become experts at raising, training, and riding them. And they became experts at horse medicine. Indians of the Great Plains could ride a horse by the age of 5. As an adult, a man would have one horse for work. Another would be specially trained for hunting.
A horse would be trained to ride into the herd. You know, and buffaloes are noted as being, although they're huge in their size, but they can turn very quickly. So a horse had to be ready and then be able to anticipate that. So you did have hunting horses that were trained to ride into a herd of buffalo.
And a third would be trained for war. An Indian warrior's success depended on how closely he and his horse worked together.
You wanted to train this horse. I mean, you were one in battle with the horse. When you went into battle, you were a brother, an ally, a comrade. So the horse was trained to fight in close skirmishes.
George Catlin was an artist who traveled in the early American West. He painted many pictures of the Indians and their horses. Catlin said the Plains Indian was the greatest rider the world had ever known. He said the moment an Indian laid a hand on his horse, he became part of the animal. Both the buffalo and the horse were extremely important to the Plains Indians. Because the horse made hunting easier, more time could be spent on other activities, including art. The Plains Indians began to make designs on their clothing and on blankets for their horses. The arrival of white settlers on the Great Plains marked the beginning of the end for the horse and buffalo culture of the Indians. Settlers did not want buffalo destroying their crops. Great numbers of buffalo were killed. By 1885, the Indians of the Great Plains were mostly restricted to areas called reservations. America's westward expansion led to violent clashes between white settlers and Native Americans. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.